how can we grow further in preaching ability? What are the next steps we can take to develop further and further skills? How can we kind of go on to a real excellence? Where can we get further training, further experience in the areas that you've been leading us in? I'm sure many of us are just so appreciative of what we've had already that we sort of say, yep, let's confirm those, let's move on further as well.
Okay.
Welcome.
Before I pretend I'm going to answer that question, let me just sort of lay out the day for you so that you'll know where we are, where we're going. The first session up until tea time, I'd like to talk at you, interact with you a bit. And then after tea time until lunch, we'll have you preach in your groups. And then following lunch, which would be at 2 o'clock from 2 to 3, we'll complete those sermons. And then at 3 o'clock, we'll come back for about a half an hour. So let me try to wrap up some of this stuff and interact, maybe pick up a few questions. And Lord willing, by 3:30, we'll have a light lunch for those of, or a tea time, light tea time for those of you who are here. But for those of you who want to get on the road and go, you can be free to go about 3:30 so that you get home at a decent time. As I look at the day, it seems to me that would be a way to handle it. I think people who are involved in preaching and do it well are always working at it and always thinking about it. I think that that means that at least once a year, it's a helpful thing to find a book on homiletics and read it. Just to stop and make that a part of your reading. I also think that if you have some friends in the ministry, they may be in the same city, but they may not, one kind of thing that you can do is to agree to take a tape and to say once every quarter, send a tape to another pastor or pastors and have them evaluate it. Two things happen. One is it's a help to listen to other preaching, and we tend to want to listen to the models of the really outstanding preachers, and that's worth doing. But it is a help to listen to people who are relatively close to you. You can often learn from how somebody close to you is doing something, so you get the benefit of hearing that. And one of the problems you have in the ministry is you don't get to listen to much preaching yourself. You're involved in doing it for others, and so that kind of a club in which you not only send the sermons, but have evaluations. What did you think the person did well? What did you learn from it? What do you think the person might improve? People committed to one another to do that for one another will do what people in the church tend not to do. And that is their level of responding to sermons is more or less, I liked it, I didn't like it. But that can be maddening because you don't know what it was they liked or didn't like. And I think that the kind of feedback you get at the door doesn't help you very much. It's all pretty subjective. So I think that's a way of working. One of the things we do in the United States is that in Denver Seminary, we have some people in our homiletics staff who for a fee, we'll evaluate sermons. The reason we make a fee, by the way, is we like money. But secondly, there would be an avalanche. That is, I think they charge $25 a sermon to do it. But they hear the sermon, they will evaluate it, and it takes about an hour and a half to do the thing well. But people are then a bit more cautious about just sending sermons because it costs them something. But short of that, you can do it for one another. And I think that is something that you can do that would be of great help so that there is always someone evaluating your sermons. The only thing I'd say about evaluating sermons is that if you send sermons to one another, or when people send them to us at the seminary, I urge them to send their what they feel is their best work. You know, we all know that life doesn't come to us in neat packages. People die at the most inopportune times. They would all die on a Tuesday morning, so you get it done and buried, so you get on your sermon preparation. But they don't. They die on a Friday night or Saturday. And when you think you're going to have quite a bit of time to study, you don't get it. Well, it's of no value to you that somebody evaluate a sermon that was a poor sermon because life crumbled in on you. Because they will be evaluating the fact that the sermon sounds like life crumbled in on you. But if you're giving it your best shot and then you get evaluated, then out of your best shot, you're able to get a more sober evaluation. So it isn't a... if you were going to do it, say, once a quarter, it would not be a bad idea to choose a sermon that would display your regular work when you're able to do what you would like to do in the course of a week. Then people are evaluating you against your strengths, not against the accidents of life that often cause us to do less than our best work. But anyhow, I would say that, and then I guess the last thing I'd say is subscribe to Exposit Tapes. That will catapult your ministry into world class, and or any service like that. Christianity Today has a thing called Preaching Today that is a sermon. There are two sermons in a workshop every month. If you're like me, you drive quite a bit, and therefore having something you can put on your recorder in the car helps you use time that's ordinarily not well used. If you listen to sermons, just listen to sermons straight on, you will not get much that will help you homiletically if you only listen to them once. You'll be benefited by them and enriched by them and all of that. What you want to do is to listen to a sermon that you think is a good sermon. Listen to it the first time for the benefit of the sermon. Listen to it the second time to sort of think about how the sermon was put together. Then listen to it a third time to try to think about its homiletics. What specifically is this person doing? By the third time through, you are not any longer enamored by the content. That is, you've heard it twice before. And you're able to look more at the structure. I find, as I listen to sermons like that, that it really takes three times through to really get to the structure. I've been listening to a series of messages by Fred Craddock, and I think Fred has a marvelous ability to use story. The first time I heard, thinking one particular sermon, I'm really moved by it. Second time, I was trying to think about the kind of thing he did, but the third time through, I could see the kinds of things he was doing. The mechanics, if I can put it that way. In good sermons, mechanics don't show through, but after you hear enough of it, you will see the mechanics. So, if you want to benefit from the model, it isn't just enough to listen to good sermons. You need to analyze what the preacher is doing. The only other thing I would say is, when you're dealing with outstanding preachers, it is often true that they have a dominant strength that overshadows many of their weaknesses. The kind of thing that happens when you're teaching homiletics is you'll work on introductions, and invariably somebody will say, well, I was listening to, John Stott. Now, he doesn't have very good introductions. The implication of that is, therefore, John Stott's great strength is bad introductions. We all have our flaws. One benefit of having a critique sheet, one benefit of thinking about homiletics, is to be able to evaluate the person's strength. If you merely copy somebody, what is interesting is we almost always copy the person's weaknesses and not the strengths. And the reason is the weaknesses stand out and the strengths don't. If a person, when I was in Texas, I think I mentioned W.A. Criswell the other day. And Criswell is sort of the patron saint of the Southern Baptist Convention, and for at least the students going to Southwestern Seminary, which is in the area, he was for a long time their model, and they would go to hear him preach. Dr. Criswell is a brilliant preacher, but he has a Criswellism, something that he does that works. He gestures late. You know, he'll say, "We're all here, all of us, aren't we?" And somehow it works for him. I mean, it's a late gesture, and it isn't good technique, but it works for him. But you'd watch the students who were in his church. "We're all here today, aren't we? And we'll be here tomorrow." And you think, you know, that isn't what made W.A. Criswell the preacher that he was. So be careful, and I think the more you listen to something, the more you're more become aware of strengths and weaknesses. But be careful that you're evaluating the person's strengths. I mean, ask yourself, what was it that this individual did that communicated God's truth to you so that it got to you? And good preachers will do a lot of things that are poor technique. They may fit with their personalities, but you're always trying to copy strengths, not weaknesses. It seems obvious, but I've taught preaching long enough to know that the danger of modeling is that you will often copy from folks the things you ought not copy and ignore the things that you ought to see. Because strengths are so much a part of what a person does, you hardly notice them. And that I would warn you against that, or else you will become a copy of somebody else. And copies, you know, you can buy copies of Rembrandt in the department store for $10, but the original hangs in the museum. And whatever God wants to do with you, you do a combination of a lot of things, but you got to be original. You got to be you. I remember working with a group of young people one time several years ago, and these were high school students that were aspiring to be preachers. I don't know what I taught them, but at the end of the week they were all talking out of the side of their mouth. I know that's one of my marvelous strengths. That happened because I got beat up when I was a kid. But it's interesting, you know, watching people try to copy a model, and they end up being a cheap imitation rather than emulating the strength. Let me lay a little theory on you. There's nothing more practical than a good theory, if it works. Because we've been talking about introductions, and there is something that comes to us out of the field of general semantics that I have found helpful. General semantics is that section of communication that deals with how communication affects the nervous system. It is not primarily interested in the communication of ideas as such, but it has to do with the way we react. And so one of the concepts in general semantics is what they call the abstraction ladder. If I want to communicate to you about a particular cat, the best way for me to communicate that cat is to bring the cat here. I would bring the cat here and show it to you, and perhaps if I thought it was really important, I would pass the cat from person to person, row to row. So at the bottom of the, at least at the lowest rung of the observable rung of the abstraction ladder, if I wanted to communicate the idea of cat, what I would do is bring the cat here. But I really can't keep bringing the cat to class. She doesn't particularly like to come. And after a while, you get sick of handling her. So in order for me to save the bringing the cat every day, we give the cat a name. We call the cat Topsy. Now, whenever I refer to Topsy, you have some kind of picture. If I brought the cat the day before, you know she's black and white, with a kind of a long tail and big whiskers. But when I use the term Topsy, I have obviously abstracted from the cat. It's hard to remember the cat as vividly as when I brought it. But often when I want to talk about Topsy, I'm not just talking about Topsy. I want to talk about cats in general. So instead of talking about Topsy, I talk about cat. Now, I have abstracted from Topsy what she has in common with other cats. If I haven't brought Topsy to class, and I say, what comes to your mind when you think of cat? Well, you may think of a black and white cat, but you may think of a Persian cat. You may think of a white cat, almost completely white. You'll probably think of a cat that you had around your house, chased mice. On the other hand, if I just use the term cat and don't have a whole lot of context, if you're a hunter, you may think of a lion or a tiger, the big cats. If you come from our Pacific Northwest and you talk about a cat and you don't define it, you're talking about one of those huge machines, the caterpillar machines that go, worst name in the world for those things, the caterpillars. I mean, they're huge. They can knock down the forest, but they're called cats. But the thing that the lion and the tiger and the Topsy have in common, whatever that is, we say, well, you know, there's a big cat, a little cat, but they have something in common. What I have done is abstracted out of Topsy and a whole bunch of other animals some characteristic that we describe as cat. I am more abstract. But I can go step higher than that, and that is I can put the cat Topsy in with animals. Now I've got her mixed up with dogs. She doesn't particularly like dogs, but there she is in that category. And she's mixed up with camels, and she also is mixed up with bears and koalas, and she's never even seen a koala, but there she is. And, you know, she's just abstracted into this. We talk about animals. I can go a step above that and perhaps abstract to mammal. If I do that, I've got Topsy all mixed up with whales, and she hates the water. But there she is. Whatever it is she has in common with a whale has to do with the way they breathe, but that's an awful abstraction from this cat I brought on Tuesday so all of you could see. And then if I go a step further, I go up to the level of living creatures. Now I've got her mixed up with fish. And believe it or not, she has just begun to have a category that she shares with angels. That last thing in the world. Anybody ever thought about Topsy was that she had an angelic quality to her. But that's what she is. Angels are living creatures. You're a living creature. You're a mammal. In that sense, you and a cat, just one and the same. Now, the point of all of this is that we abstract. And that's one of the ways we learn to think. When you are in school getting an education, What happens in school is that you learn to go up the abstraction ladder. You go to seminary or go to Bible college, they give you all kinds of abstractions. You go into seminary talking about what's going to happen when Jesus comes back. And you come out of seminary talking about eschatology. Go into, you know, Bible school talking about murder, rape, and robbery. You leave talking about the problem of hematology. What you've done is abstract. Now, there's nothing wrong with that, because abstractions of that sort are a shorthand by which people in a particular discipline are able to communicate. So part of being educated is that you learn to use labels in order to understand concepts. We took a brief stroll through your botanical gardens yesterday. Oh, man. I mean, my level of a botanical garden is, oh, that's a tree. And if you said to me, what kind of tree is it? It's a green tree. My wife Bonnie's a bit more sophisticated. She said, no, that's a gum tree. But if you go there with Alan Gordon, he gives you Latin names. You know, he went to agricultural school for 2 years, and so he's been, he goes over there and he's got all kinds of abstractions as he's watching, looking at trees. One of the benefits is that Alan can look at trees and see what I don't see. Because by being able to abstract and put things into categories, what is to me either a green tree or a tree that's turning brown or it's got purple flowers, the more you are able to put things in categories, the better able you are to see them. I say all of that because I don't want to downgrade education. As you get an education, you learn to abstract. But if you are going to communicate, instead of going up the abstraction ladder, you have to come down the abstraction ladder. If you stay on a high level of abstraction, you don't communicate. So if you read theological papers, often what is passed off as scholarly is just stuffy. And the reason it's stuffy is they don't want you to come down this ladder because it's too plain, too concrete, too specific, and it is also, when you stay up here, boring. Scholarly papers are not written to communicate. They're written to impress. If they wanted to communicate, they'd learn how to write. But because in academia all these people understand these abstractions and they're writing to one another, the people in the academy write for the academy. Okay, but if they want to really communicate what they're talking about to people on the street, to people outside the discipline, if a psychologist wants to talk to a sociologist, he can't stay at this level. As you well know, if you've been at the schools, the people in the psychology department can't communicate with the people in the sociology department. I mean, that's literally true. I took sociology. I thought they were all sort of one of the same thing when I went in. They can't talk to each other. Why? Because they stay at this high level. And the people within that discipline understand it, but when it comes to talking to people in another discipline, they can't do it. And I mean, literally, they can't do it. Sometimes you get somebody who lives between the two of them, and it's sort of like a translator. But until you can come down that abstraction ladder, you don't communicate. Now, that means that if I wanted to define a slaughterhouse for you, at one level I could say it's a place where cattle or animals are killed and processed so that the meat can be eaten. That's fairly high level. The best way to define a slaughterhouse for you is to take you to a slaughterhouse. If you were in the United States, to take you to Chicago, to where the slaughterhouses are. Let you smell it. Let you see it. Once I do that, you'll never forget what a slaughterhouse is. And you'll never have to go to a dictionary to find out. You'll know. The closer I can get to your experience, the better I can define the term. So, So what I do, I need to do as a communicator, is be constantly coming down this abstraction ladder. And the closer I can get to the cat itself, so that you can see the cat, the stronger the sermon is going to be in terms of communication. And that's why sometimes when you send people to seminary or Bible school, the person in the pew says, good night. They went in, they got spoiled when they were there. Because you're learning to go up the ladder, and they do not spend much time getting you to come down the ladder. That applies to a lot of things. It applies to illustrations. It applies to style, to the use of wording. It applies to the way you develop a sermon. Because anything you can do to come down that ladder so that people can taste and see and hear and experience, the closer you can do that, the stronger your communication will be. If there's one basic principle I'd like to get across to you is this. People think with pictures in their minds. And if I can get you not only to think of a concept, but to experience it, then I have succeeded. I was saying to some folks yesterday, there is no such thing as grace. There is only someone being gracious and someone receiving grace. There's no such thing as love, as though there's a box in heaven and has love on the outside. I'd like 2 pounds of love today. No such thing as love. There's only someone loving and someone being loved. When Jesus told the story that Bill Hybels gave us the other day about the prodigal son, our tendency is to shrug it off, or at least since Jesus told that we give it high marks, but anybody else who does it, we give them low marks. We shrug it off, but the power of that story, when it is fully expounded, is it's a father's heart who is broken, and a boy who goes to the far country, and a youngster who comes back, and a father who welcomes him. It's somebody alienated, somebody being redeemed. That's the way theologians talk. Until we are able to take the alienation of humanity and bring it to the redemptive power of the propitious God, we will not be able to enter in, existentially at least, to the full-orbed majesty of the Almighty. That's just junk. I mean, that's junk. What you're really saying is, until we come to the place that we know we have sinned and we can feel in our stomach the hunger that comes from being in the pig pen, and we can feel in our mouths the dryness of what it is to live away from the Father's house, and we say, I have blown it. Until we decide we're going to go back and say, Dad, I'm sorry. Until we do that, we don't even know what it's all about. Same thing. It's quite scholarly, but it communicates. So you get the jargon. I wish for us, those of us who have to deal with the trenches, I wish we could get rid of all words that ended in dumb, like martyrdom, or hood, motherhood, or ship, fellowship. Motherhood. Mother's Day. And on this marvelous day, we celebrate motherhood and all of the benefits that motherhood has to mankind. Man, until you can get that mother with an apron around her cooking the meals in the kitchen with 2 kids pulling at her dress, you haven't gotten the motherhood. Motherhood's some abstraction. Mothers, I understand. Children tugging on the dress, I understand that. But there hadn't been a mother in the world ever been inspired by the fact that she's part of motherhood. But that's abstraction. And that's the language you often get in the pulpit. Don't kid yourself. That's the kind of stuff that doesn't communicate. It says something, but it doesn't say anything to people's experience. They don't see anything. They don't experience it. They don't hear it. They don't taste it. And that's what you're about. I'm not talking about grace, but someone being gracious, someone receiving grace. You're not in the business of talking about love. I'm talking about somebody loving and somebody being loved. Okay, one way in which we do this is by the use of illustrations. And illustrations, or specific instances, are able to restate a truth, they're able to explain a truth, they're able to prove a truth psychologically, they are able to apply a truth. And illustrations are the concretions, are able to do all the things you have to do in a sermon. The question then is, what are the characteristics of a good illustration? Use them, and good preachers use them. They are specific, they are concrete. Well, one thing a good illustration should do is it ought to illustrate. The verb to illustrate is a transitive verb. Remember back in your English class, the transitive verb has an object. That is, there's no such thing as a good illustration. There is only a good illustration of a particular truth. Now, you may have a ripping good story, but it's not an illustration until it illustrates a truth. The great danger of illustrations is they make better masters than they do servants. That is, a preacher can become a storyteller. And he tells the story for the sake of the story. And you know that that's great stuff because people listen. But you're not in the business of telling stories. You're in the business of getting across God's truth. So you've got to hitch those horses up to a wagon. If the horses aren't pulling anything and just romping around the pasture, you can't use them. They are only valuable to you as they are serving the truth. So they need to illustrate. Putting another way, an illustration that is effective is not like the stained glass windows that you see in a cathedral. Because you look at the stained glass window and you see the stained glass. My, look at the stained. Isn't that lovely? Boy, wonderful. No, illustrations are like the glass at the walls of this church. You look over and say, oh, look, the flower. That is, you see through the pane of glass to what is outside. So illustrations must illustrate. They help people to see the truth. Putting it simply, the illustration ought not be told for its own sake. It's told for the sake of the truth you are trying to communicate. Second thing about illustrations is that illustrations should be understandable. The basic principle we are working on is that we're going to illustrate the unknown by the known. Okay? That is, the truth is a bit vague. I'm going to use something that people know to illustrate the unknown. That very simple principle often gets neglected. But again, let's think a bit about some theory. If you think about your listener, the listener has basically two spheres of experience. One is this inner core of personal experience. This is the kind of thing that the listener has done. This is the boy she has kissed. This is the dog he has owned. This is the house he lived in when he was growing up. It's his inner core of experience. The personal interaction the individual has had with life. But then there is an outer core of experience, what we might call the listener's vicarious experience. The kind of thing that they, the listener, has not experienced directly, but through reading, seeing television, or as or watching motion pictures, or going to a museum. They have this as part of their experience. Some of what they have in this vicarious experience is very close to the core. If you go to see a gripping movie, you in a sense are enmeshed by that movie for 3 hours. You haven't really been to the western part of the United States and been involved with Indians, but if you're an American, at least that can be pretty close to this experience. You almost feel you've been there. Then, of course, out here would be stuff you've read about that had to do with ancient Rome, ancient Greece. And you may have visited Italy and been to Rome and, you know, seen the ruins, but that isn't really, you know, first-rate experience to you. It's out here on the fringes. Okay. Then, if you think about it, you as the preacher also have those two areas. Got your personal experience, the girls you've dated, the wife you've married, children you've had. The hunting that you have done. Trips to the outback that you have taken. And you also have this vicarious experience. Things you have read about or somebody's told you about. Some of it may be close to your center, but some of it may be distant. Now, when you think about illustrations, the best illustrations are the illustrations that come where your personal experience overlaps the listener's personal experience. These are the stories that we often call human interest stories. That's why stories about the babies or dogs or references to comic strips or references to television programs everybody's seen. That's why they're effective. Because you're talking out of your personal experience, you've experienced it, you've been there, and the listener has been there. This is the strongest kind of illustration. It's strong because not only does the illustration illustrate a truth, it helps people experience it. It brings the emotional dimension into the message. We have been magnificently hosted this week by Colin and Barbara O'Connor. If God has made any more gracious people, I want to bump into them because they are just lovely, lovely, lovely people. And this morning, we were chatting about something that had happened when Colin was growing up 60-some years ago. He was talking about the fact that when he was a boy, He and some of his friends found a bath, or a bathtub, as we call it. And they decided what they're going to do is go take it to a hillside, and they would get in it, and, you know, it would be like a sled. They'd down and go. We're sure it's going to work. So they got his sister to ride it first. All the best schemes of mice and men and little boys go astray, and instead of going down the hill, the thing just tumbled. And she fell out, had some rocks in it to keep it balanced. They fell out, you know. He sat there, and as he was telling that story, he was into it. And he was laughing. I mean, laughing, deeply laughing. And we laughed. You know why? Because when I was growing up in New York City, Riverside Drive, I remember not doing that. I remember taking a sled and going down a huge hill and not checking out whether there was snow all the way down. That's when I learned that you need snow for sled. All right. Both of us had been on a hill. Both of us as kids had, you know, done something. It wasn't an identical experience. And as he laughed and told that story, we laughed. Entered into it. Touched by it. The fact he got his sister to ride. I didn't have a sister, but I had an older cousin that would get me to ride. I'm dumber than I look, you believe it. I mean, he'd tell me, no, go ahead, you know, try it out. I do it. It didn't work. He knew. But as he told that story, he laughed, and he was once again a boy. He was once again growing up in the Depression. And once again, I was a boy. Had he been illustrating a truth, aside from the fact that you're fortunate to have a little sister, I would have been deeply moved. We were laughing, but I would have been deeply moved. Why? Because he was touching this area. Good preachers are always going there. The second best area of illustration is where your vicarious experience, what you've read about, heard about, overlaps the listener's personal experience. As much as possible, I want to talk into the listener's experience. So, I want to do whatever I can to draw out of that person's inner experience what I can. So, for example, in our country, and I suspect it's true with yours, if you're talking to young people, their language is music. Several years ago, when I had to speak to a high school group, I asked my son, who was then one of the world's great experts on junior high school kids. I don't know what that would be. I don't know if you have junior high school here, but expert, because he was just a few years away from it at the time. He's grown out of it. I said, what can I do? How do I get to him? He said, Dad, I want to look in the paper. Every Sunday they have a list of the top 40. If you just came to a high school group and you read that list and you said that, you know, these are the ones that are making the charts this week, and you got to read them every week because they go in the charts one week and they're out the next. Seems to me the themes that are there have to do with love and wanting to be wanted. You know, that's what you have. Just a preacher reading the list says, you know, I know your world. And I'm not here to put it down. I want to learn about where you're at because of your music. Okay? That's what I mean by talking into the personal experience. It's risky because sometimes you're so much an outsider that you give it all away. But if I'm talking to young people, I know there are things that I have experienced that they haven't experienced. I remember saying to a seminary group one time, you know, we all remember where we were when President Kennedy was assassinated. Guy said, I wasn't even a glint in my father's eye at that time. You know, it was all before they were born. Very real to me, in my inner experience, it wasn't real to them. I've got to talk to them about them, okay? Third best area is where your personal experience overlaps their vicarious experience. As I have mentioned, I think once before, I grew up in the ghetto of New York City. It's a place infected with juvenile gangs. You had to be in a gang in order, or at least associated with a gang in order to live. That's real to me. It doesn't take long for me to talk about that I can smell the urine in the halls, see the garbage in the streets, the glass, broken glass on the sidewalk. Real to me. I can talk about that with a great deal of feeling and vividness because it's personal. A lot of people would have heard of inner city gangs, not experienced it. But it would overlap their vicarious experience. But because I can tell it vividly, it's still a very effective kind of illustration. I can put myself into it. Now, I must be sure that I am least speaking to the vicarious experience. I think all of us have heard missionaries who talk out of their personal experience, but they're out here someplace. They don't touch us at all. A missionary very familiar with Africa, you know, says, now, we have spent the last 20 years on the Ivory Coast. At least where I come from, if you think the average person sitting there could identify the Ivory Coast on a map, in fact, they couldn't find Africa on a map, many of them. And if I'm going to talk to these people, it isn't good enough to assume they've heard of the country. Well, it's out here. But if I know that I want to describe what is taking place, if I talk about working in a country area and I describe this country area, I can assume that people even in the city have an awareness of that and I can speak out of this. That's the third area. Fourth area is where the preacher's vicarious experience overlaps the listener's vicarious experience. This is the weakest area. This would be like an illustration that comes from ancient Rome or ancient Greece. Sometimes you got to give it because you're talking about ancient Rome and ancient Greece. And in order to understand the passage, you've got to do that. Occasionally, there is an illustration, and I mean an illustration of a truth, so strong that it's worth going back to the Middle Ages to illustrate it. But you've got to know that that is not a strong area for illustration. Because it isn't out of your central experience, and it doesn't touch your audience's central experience. It's what you've read about, what they've read about. And therefore, it carries very little emotional load. There is a fifth area that people, preachers, ministers like us use, and that is something out of our personal experience or our vicarious experience that has nothing at all to do with the listener's inner or outer experience. You know what I mean? You're over here someplace. And the kind of illustration I have in mind are biblical illustrations. I know if you read the homiletitians, and especially those who have a kind of devotional flair, they say the best illustrations are Bible illustrations. You know, he's able to go back in the Old Testament illustrate. Unless your crowd's different than the crowd I'm trying to reach today, you discover that your people don't know the Bible. I mean, they don't know it. I think it's interesting, for all the piety that goes with it, if you study the illustrations that Jesus used, that Jesus doesn't use an illustration out of the Old Testament unless he's talking to the religious leaders. He's talking to ordinary people. He's talking about runaway boys and a woman who lost her grocery money and a shepherd going after a sheep and a guy who got swindled in a business deal and a rich man who had no time for beggars. His references to the Old Testament made to a Nicodemus who was a leader of the Jews. Ordinary people didn't use the Old Testament. So, at least I've got Jesus on my side. If you want to try to counter that? What I'm saying is that biblical illustrations don't illustrate. You're going from the unknown to the unknown. Now, you back off. If you use a biblical illustration, then you better know that you've got to spend time with that illustration and tell it in such a vivid, personal, interesting way that you bring it into people's experience. I mean, you hear a preacher say to a congregation, you remember how God dealt with David when he sinned. I put my hand up and say, want to bet? David who? He was in the paper last week, wasn't he? Well, if you're going to tell that story, you better get in there and tell it. And tell it in such a way that it now becomes vivid, for a moment at least, in people's minds. And that takes time. You're not going to toss that off in 3 minutes. So you have to decide, I got a certain amount of time. If I have time to say 5-6 minutes to tell this story, put it in its setting, make people see it, help them grip it, and then illustrate, okay, you can do that. But just the references as we used to use them to biblically literate people, if they were there ever, they are not there now. And the purpose of an illustration is to illustrate. And the principle is you go to illustrate the unknown from the known. So probably says, yeah, but you know, it's good to teach them the Bible. Look, you got enough trouble teaching them Ephesians than to try at the same time to bring in the book of 1 Samuel. Want to teach 1 Samuel? Teach 1 Samuel. But they are not good illustrations in terms of communication. I know I've just ruined half your sermons. All right, let me stop. Do you have any questions about this thus far, or attacks you'd like to make, or yes? Say it again.
The second best part was when the verse Zacharias points overlap.
Yeah, probably in my.
And your fourth point was facing the sign.
Okay, here, let me see if I. Let me get. The best kind is where the personal experiences of you and the audience overlap. The second best is where your vicarious, your outer ring, overlaps their inner ring. Okay. The third best is where your personal life story overlaps what they know about vicariously. The fourth kind is where your vicarious experience and their vicarious experience overlaps. And the fifth kind I talked about was the kind that are outside the circle. Okay. Yes. Somebody got a microphone? Oh, go ahead.
One thing you haven't mentioned, WC, is just how people's resistance to new concepts comes into the factor. You know, we can kind of communicate something, but if people have a mental block about something in their head, we need to get over that. Can you talk
about that? The question is, if people have a mental block about something in their heads, how do you get overcome it?
Well, what things are the cause of the
Well, that's a good question. What is it likely to cause the block? You know what a palimpsest is? I'm really complimenting you by asking a question like that. in the ancient world, in you know, when paper was tough to get, what they would do is they would have papyri leaf and they would have other kinds of parchment. And so the palimpsest is a manuscript in which often there was a copy of the Bible. And they didn't, you know, didn't have a lot of paper, so what they would do is sort of scrape off the Greek, and then they would write a sermon on top of it or something else. Or you could do it the other way around. You could wipe off a sermon and put on the biblical text. The palimpsest is a thing in which the bottom message was erased, and then a message was put on top of it. Okay? Now, if you think of people, they're like, you know, they're like a parchment. They didn't come to church with blank tablets. They've got a whole lot of writing there. So sometimes I've got to think about that audience and realize that if I'm going to get this across, I've got to scratch out a place and clean it up so I can write my message there. See if I can illustrate what I'm saying. John Baker used to write for the New York Times. And he said that when he was a boy living in Baltimore, Maryland, in our country, his father had died, and his mother was able to rent a flat from an undertaker. And it was a pretty good arrangement. She kept the premises clean. The only difficulty was that if he got a lot of business, they not only had the main parlor, but they would use the parlor of the apartment in which Baker and his mother lived. And they would, you know, lay the corpse out. And he said the undertaker would cater to the people that came who sat up at the corpse in the wake. It was a custom with the Irish and people in Europe to sit up all night with the corpse. The corpse wasn't going to go anyplace, but they just felt it was decent, you know, to do that. So in order to provide for them, he says in his autobiography, he would supply boiled shrimp so that they would be able to eat. Well, many of them drink beer at the same time. That was part of the wake. You know, give them something to do to go through the night. And Baker said, to this day, when I eat, or in a restaurant, see broiled shrimp, I think of death. Well, you know, as a preacher, you can't know that. But that means any reference to broiled shrimp, if you really wanted to get across the concept of broiled shrimp, and you knew that Baker was there, you'd have to get a place in that parchment. When I talk about broiled shrimp, I'm not talking about death. You have to work at that. So when people come, and you have a concept, and you know that out of their past, they have a certain experience. Sometimes you got to say, let me take some time, kind of erase a place. You can do that by using an inductive message. Sometimes you can just face it by telling people how they feel. Bringing to the front the writing that's there. You find this with a passage. You take the passage in the Gospels and Acts that have to do with the death of Judas. One text says he hung himself. Others, he was dashed against the stones. Remember that? If you preach the second text, that Judas death fell ripped apart by the stones, what kind of people out there say, no, he hung himself. That's what we know about. He hung himself. You don't stop telling there are two accounts, and perhaps a hint as to how biblical scholars put those together. You don't do that. And this person knows that he hung himself. You can preach that whole sermon about Judas. Folks, you know, he didn't fall against the stone, he hung himself. If you preach the Lord's Prayer from Luke 12, Luke 11, you know, it's the abbreviated one. Father, hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, give us this day our daily bread. Matthew is, Father who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. You know, it's an extended one. I have preached the Lord's Prayer from Luke 11. And, I mean, I'm in the text. It's open. People go out and say, what happened to our Father who art in heaven? How come you didn't have that part in there about thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven? How come that wasn't in there? Or even worse, how come you don't have that part in there about thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever? So what's, you know, that's not in the original text. I mean, it's not in the original text. I mean, it's not in the original text. It was added by the church later on to, you know, round out the prayer. It comes out of the Old Testament. I mean, I've had people write me letters. You know, I mean, nasty letters. Well, that was my fault. That was my fault. It's writing. I should have gotten a place there to say, look, let me tell you why that's not there. So you're always asking, if that's there, I've got to make a space. If I don't make a space, it doesn't work. You can't write over writing and make it. Now the problem is you can't know everybody in your congregation. But if you know that this is true for a large group, basic to persuasion is whenever you encounter an objection in the minds of the audience, you've got to deal with it there. You may simply do no more than acknowledge it. But if you don't do anything with it, folks got this thing written there. So that sometimes it's amazing. You could say, I understand that one of the questions that people have at this point is, I really cannot deal with that today, but I understand it's a question and it is worth looking at. That doesn't sound like you're going to do much, but that's far better than if you know the question is there, not to face it. Because it just sticks in their mental craw. Sometimes illustrations can help overcome that. Because it helps you to identify with an audience. Okay, one other thing about illustrations is they ought to be convincing. And I mean by that, as much as lies in you, they ought not have an error in fact. And again, the more antagonistic your audience, the more that's going to bother people. I was holding forth up in Detroit, Michigan several years ago. And in the course of the sermon, I said, I don't know what I was talking about now, but I said, you know, snakes are slimy and poisonous, repulsive. I was talking about going on, I don't know. On the way out, after it was over, a woman came up to me, very intelligent woman. She said to me, you're dead wrong about snakes. I said, I couldn't even remember the reference. I mean, it wasn't one of the major points in my sermon. And she said, you said that they were slimy and poisonous. Well, I said, the ones I met, I think, were. She said, most snakes aren't poisonous. In fact, if we didn't have snakes, we'd be overrun by rats. I mean, snakes serve a great... And she went on. And I said, I guess They're not slimy. She said, they're not. You ever held a snake? I said, not if I could help it. She said, they're very dry. Turned out she worked at the zoo in Detroit. You know, it was her life. I mean, you know, she was into snakes. Well, interesting. I mean, obviously the rest of the congregation all agreed with me. Snakes don't have good public relations officers. But for that woman, that was the end of the sermon. You know, because I was dead wrong. I thought I was right. I was wrong. It's amazing if you're wrong in your facts and people know the facts, what that can do to you. I have a physician friend in Dallas, Texas, who switched churches. Because he said, his pastor always used science to illustrate. I don't know where he picked that up, but he was using a lot of science. And he said, if he's as wrong in his theology as he is about his science, I couldn't stand to listen to him. Because Sunday after Sunday, he's dead wrong in the science. Well, he's wrong in his facts. And so, as much as lies in you, you know, try to be true. You can check things in an encyclopedia. I don't know about your world here, but in our world, it's possible to pick up a phone and call the library and ask them to check some facts for you. Just helps. It even more, it ought not offend common sense. There's a story that's made the rounds about the Vietnam War, in which the communists came into a village that had a number of Christians, and that the leader of the village was a Christian man. The communist lieutenant said to this Christian leader, you must recant, you must turn your back upon Christianity. The man refused. And he said, if you do not deny Jesus Christ, I'll kill you. He said, well, my life's in his hands. So the lieutenant took this Christian leader out into the woods and tied him to a tree, put honey over his legs, and the ants, which I guess are vicious, were allowed to attack him. Before he left, communist said, is there anything you want to say? Christian leader said, yes. I would like you to tell my son that I have died for Jesus Christ and I'd like him to take my place. Very moving story. I woke up to problems with that. One kind of problem I have has been told, it was told in the Korean War, it was told in the Vietnam War, if we fight long enough, it's going to be some guy took him out in the desert. Second question I have is, who in the world told his son? I mean, this communist come back and say, let me tell you what your father said. I mean, I can't imagine that happening. If you get a story that offends common sense, at least if you're, you know, made of my kind of clay, sit down and think, how in the world that happened? And there are a lot of preacher stories that do offend common sense. We had one going around the country. In fact, it got in the newspapers that they in one of the laboratories in New Jersey, they were doing some celestial calculations, and they discovered that as they were trying to put all this together, it was 12 hours off. They couldn't get it, something wrong with the way the universe is put together. And one of the men that was in that experiment remembered the Old Testament story. Sun standing still. And it counted for the hours. Students at the seminary brought me this clipping from the paper. You know, this marvelous stuff. All I said was, we'll pay for it, use our phone, call long distance, call the laboratory, see if it's true. It wasn't. I mean, that story's too good to be true. I mean, you know, you had that kind of stuff, you're home free. You just know that that's just too good to be true. But it circulated so much, it hit the newspapers. And, yes, you, I know your uncle works at the laboratory, and he was the one who found it. Yeah. Yeah.
Australia and was also discounted, but later I found it written in a book called How to Be a King's Kid, and it was documented, the scientific institution in the whole world.
I know everything about it except that it's not true. Yeah, I mean, but those are the kind of stories that can really come out and bite you, because if a young person hears a story like that and believes you and believes that it's true and then later discovers it's a hoax, they don't just discount the illustration, they discount a whole lot of things. I mean, let me be fair, you know, you read it in a, if I read that in Time magazine, I would say to people, 2 weeks ago in Time magazine, this is what I read. So that if you want to check it, it's in Time. If Time's wrong, that's Time's problem. So that I would shift the authority away from me to wherever I read it, even in a newspaper, to say, you know, this is an amazing story. It was in a newspaper. At least I want to discount my using my authority in order to enforce that story, simply because it'll rise up and bite you.
There's another one going around at the moment about Russian scientists having dug a hole
about
9 miles into the crust of the earth and hearing screams coming out.
I know.
With 2,000 degrees of heat. I don't know how anyone exists in 2,000 degrees Celsius.
You've got a bunch of asbestos devils down there. But that hit the papers in the United States, too. Although, I must say, when it hit the papers in the United States, when it was reported, there was a large tongue and a large cheek. But for Christians sometimes to pick that up, all I'm saying is it ought not offend common sense. What?
Grooms,
who's
professor of evangelism at Liberty University.
Yeah, what did you get from him?
He told me that exact thing. Real excited.
Well, get hold of him.
that was discounted in Christianity. That magazine, Christianity Explained, Christianity Today, had an article where they traced it back to its roots and showed the nonsense of it.
Yeah, okay. And it's good to have somebody like Christianity Today to do that. All right, let me talk about collecting them, saving them. The proverb says that the slothful man roasts not what he caught in hunting. In other words, he didn't go out and hunt anything, and therefore he had nothing to eat. You don't have illustrations. You got to stalk them, and you have to stock them. In a way, they become a certain magnificent obsession. An ant knows that you've got to store things up in the summer to have food in the winter. So if you've got the brain of an ant, you will follow the same principle. You need to be looking for illustrations. The question is, where do you find them? Well, one of the places you find them is in your own personal experience. Somebody has said that every soul is a circus. The only question is, can you get admission to your own soul? That is, you have to be able to observe in order to see. Some people can get more illustrations taking a walk around the block than other people could take taking a trip around the world. So the question is, you know, do you look? But your personal experience is a great place. Just a couple of things. Often people object. They say, you ought not go to your personal experience. In fact, sometimes you hear a preacher say, if you'll pardon this personal experience. By the way, let me put a footnote here. The worst thing you can do in a sermon at any point is to apologize. It doesn't do any good. All it does is call attention to something. Person that gets up on a Sunday morning and says, yesterday and the day before were very, very difficult days. I really didn't have the time to prepare that I wanted to have. I hope you'll pardon me. If you think that person in the eighth row is saying, oh, I grant you my pardon, my son. They'll pardon you for that. All you've told them is you can expect a crummy sermon for the next 20 minutes. It may not be any worse than the others you preach. why point it out? In fact, you may discover some day go stumbling through it and people go out and say, my, that was wonderful. Sometimes your vulnerability is great. But to apologize gets you nowhere. And when people are going to say, you'll pardon the personal experience, all you're saying to the people in the pew is there must be something dreadfully wrong with using a personal experience. They didn't think it was wrong, but you told them it was wrong, so, it must be wrong. What is wrong with personal experiences is when you boast. I mean, if you're always the hero of your stories, you don't like to talk to a boor in private. Why should you want to hear one in public? I was downtown and I was talking to a person about his faith. He wasn't a Christian. He said this, I said this, he said this, I said this, he said this, and boy, did I top him. You may do that every so often. You win some. But most of the illustrations that you do have nothing to do with whether you're a hero or a goat. But you want to make yourself a goat, that's fine. If you're dumb enough to do it a lot, that's your stupidity. I mean, people are going to figure out this guy, kind of stupid. Usually, though, they're kind of neutral. The things that have happened. You're not the hero, you're not the villain. They've happened. It's personal. The story that I was referring to earlier that we're talking about at the breakfast table. My host was not the hero. He was a slight villain getting his sister to ride the tub. But he didn't have those feelings. That was just a good story. And we laughed together. So it would have been a marvelous illustration if there was a truth behind it. It's personal. Tell them. The only other thing I'd say is don't apologize for them, because there's nothing to apologize for. But you can't violate a confidence. I mean, that's crucial, isn't it? And boy, there is a temptation to do it. I don't know how many times I'll be working on a message and an illustration comes walking into my office. I mean, you get in this conversation and it's big. I mean, this is like, and you can't use it. You'd be divulging a confidence. Sometimes, though, you can enhance your reputation as a counselor and the confidential side of it by doing something like this. Years ago, a preacher in New York City, Dr. McCracken, began a sermon on loneliness. He said, I received a letter a couple of weeks ago from a young woman who had just moved to New York City. And it touched me so much that I asked her permission to read it to you. And the letter simply said that she'd come to New York. She'd come from a small town. And here she was in the middle of 8 million people. And she was lonelier than she'd ever been in her life. And that she had more friends in that small town. And the question she was raising is, how do you come to grips with loneliness? And that was what he did. Well, by introducing it as he did, there was no scandal. She wasn't saying that she was a prostitute or anything like that. I mean, she's just lonely. But by saying, I asked her permission to read this to you, was saying to that congregation, if you write me a letter even about loneliness, and nobody would have picked the woman out of the crowd. I mean, you get all the lonely people in New York, they get rid of 7.5 million of them. I mean, everybody's lonely in New York. So nobody would say, oh, that's her, that red-headed girl over there. You know, nobody would say that. But by doing that, he said to them, I will not violate a confidence without asking the permission person to do that. But you can't do it. And sometimes you can, in a church, you can disguise it and all the rest. But if that person sitting out there is sensitive about what is occurring, I mean, nobody else in that congregation might have a ghost of an idea of who it is, but that person, if you put the spotlight on me, everybody's looking. You can't violate a confidence. And that's tough when you're a pastor, because you live in the world of these people. Sometimes you can make something very hypothetical. You can disguise it in that you're saying it didn't happen, or you can make it a conglomerate, something of this sort. But it's still, you know, risky business. Another place you can get illustrations, one out of your personal experience, second out of your reading. The really good illustrations come from the comic strips, from nursery rhymes. You've got small children, you read nursery rhymes to your children, children's stories. By all means, check them out for illustrations. Probably there's nothing more beguiling than something that is very familiar used in an unfamiliar way. Alright, just it catches you by surprise. So to take a children's nursery rhyme or a children's story and use it. What you're doing, you see, is it's probably nothing closer to the center than stories you read to your children. And if you can capture that, it's good stuff. Then find magazines and sometimes textbooks. I think sometimes books of sermons will help you. Even books of sermons, sermon illustrations. What I do is, when I get a book of sermon illustrations, I just read through them. To the ones that sort of leap out, and I think, boy, that really does illustrate the point. The danger is keeping them on your shelf. And then, you know, in desperation, on Saturday you go to this canned stuff, and it comes through canned, because it wouldn't be the kind of thing you'd use in 100 years if you weren't desperate. You can make up better illustrations than that. But if you just read them, you know, and you say, man, that's a good illustration. Save it. Sermons, I think, are a better place to get illustrations because you get them in context. There's a book of sermon illustrations by Clarence McCartney, an outstanding preacher in America in days gone by. And the reason it's outstanding is they not only give you the illustration, but it gives you like a paragraph before, so you see the flow of thought. But you get that when you have sermons. Listening to conversations. You got to do what a novelist does. I keep this little, you know, I keep 3x5 cards with me. But you listen to people talk. And sometimes just the way people say something catches you. I was talking to some of our African to an African student just before I left, and he was complaining a bit about the regulations we had at the seminary, or the hoops you have to jump through, and it was clear that he would not have had those hoops to jump through. But he said to me, whenever the alligator is the tailor, he knows where to put the hole in the suit. Think about that. I mean, the alligator's making a suit, he knows you put a big hole back here because the rest of them got to stick out. In other words, we're the tailors, we don't put any holes in there for alligators, I guess. And I jot that down. I mean, that's a fascinating way of saying something. A lie will take you far, but it will never take you home. The person in the southeast say that. You try to explain that in words, abstraction. It takes you a paragraph. It captures something. But listening to conversation, how do people express their grief?
Let me give you an experiment that you might want to do. Take a situation. Suppose, take a situation in which a 17-year-old girl has not been invited to a prom or a special party at the school. All the other kids are going, but she hasn't been invited. Write out in a paragraph, how does she feel? I don't mean write, she is very sad. But what would she think? How would she feel? What emotions would she have? And then try to check it out with her, your wife at least, or 17-year-old. Or, here's a man 55 years of age. He's been fired from his job. He has no superannuation. He's no pension in our world. I mean, and he doesn't know where he's going to get another job. Just write a paragraph. How does that man feel? What goes through his mind? What emotions? And how does he experience the emotion? He feels the ball of fear growing in his stomach. He wakes up in the middle of the night and breathes the sad stench of failure. And he worries about his kids who are in college. They're even going to get through. And he doesn't even know where to look for a job. He dreads the morning because he doesn't know what to do with it. What does a man do? How does he feel? Take anything. If you can put that into a paragraph, just sit in the plane, put it in the paragraph. The other day, I got to thinking about Jim Baker, the Secretary of State in the United States. And he met with the ambassador from Iraq. I just sort of scribbled and threw it away. What would you feel like if the weight of the war rested on you? If this thing didn't come off. Young men and women on both sides would die. How do you feel going into that conference? How do you describe that? What would that be like? You may be wrong, but I'll tell you this. If you are able to touch people's feelings that way, you will find yourself, as you do that, listening to conversations as to how ordinary people express the toughness of life. And if you can bring some of that into a sermon, it has a way of saying, he knows me. Just how do ordinary people say it? Preachers in the airport. You don't have to spend a lot of time, but you meet a lot of people. Just listen. I was in an airport in Chicago getting my shoe shine. And the shoe shine man was talking to the fellow next to him, talking about relatives that wanted money. He said, you ever notice the dog that brushes up against you is always wet? Yeah, that's good. Yeah. He caught something in that imagery. You may use it sometime, you may not. But if you think about those things, it makes what you're doing concrete. All right, what you got to do is to file them. I try, as a discipline, to file 20 illustrations a week. And the reason is that the process is as important as the product. At this point in my life, that illustration file is important to me. Our rule was, when our kids were with us, if we had a fire, we'd go in and save the illustrations, and then if the kids were inside, we'd go back and get the kids. I mean, easier to get two kids than it is to get a whole bunch of illustrations, I want you to know. If you carry a 3x5 cards with you, when you read, jot it down. In the jotting it down, in the process, you begin to look at how people make a point and make it well. You begin to become more observant. I have in the book how I
set up my 3x5 card file. It's by letters of the alphabet and the first vowel. So atonement would be under A-O, A-T-O. And then under that, everything would be alphabetical within that category. Also have a books of the Bible file. I have an illustration or a comment, someplace that applies to a particular passage of Scripture. I use the 3x5 card file. Many times you'll discover, for instance, if you're in a commentary in Romans 5, there is a good insight as to what happens in Genesis chapter 3. Now, I don't file what I have in Romans 5 if I'm in a commentary in Romans. I know I'm going to go back to that. But I know I'm not going to, if I'm in Genesis 3, think of a commentary in Romans. So that's what I would put down in that. And if I get a story, I will put that. I also have a large file, which I file of larger materials. And the Baker Book Company in our country has a filing system. Any filing system will work if you'll work it. Yes? Yeah. That's right. That's a good... Yeah, you know, you guys, most of you are into computers, and I'm still back in the pencil stage. But you're right, because you can easily cross-reference things with a computer, where I have to do it. I shouldn't say that. My assistant does it by